Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For decades, best-selling novelist Pat Conroy has taken readers on passionate journeys south of the Mason-Dixon line and deep into the human psyche. Conroy puts everything on the table. In The Great Santini, he exposed a military father's brutality. In The Prince of Tides, his Tom Wingo unpacks a sister's suicide on the Carolina coast and in a Manhattan psychiatrist's office. Robert Duvall and Barbara Streisand ran with those books in Hollywood. His new novel, out this week, is South of Broad. It's set in his beloved Charleston, South Carolina. And everything is on the table again. Love, lust, race, religion, the Catholic Church, and a whole lot of Charleston. This hour, On Point novelist Pat Conroy is with us. You can join the conversation. Have you been there with Pat Conroy since The Great Santini, The Prince of Tides, Lords of Discipline, Beach Music? What is it about his treatment of taboo topics like dysfunctional families, suicide, mental illness, and struggling souls that makes them the stuff of moving bestsellers? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Birmingham, Alabama, is Pat Conroy. His new novel, just out, is South of Broad, his first novel in 14 years. Pat Conroy, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. It's really great to have you right there. We tried and missed last week, but we're glad you're back, Pat, and thank you so much for joining us. 14 years.
No, it's a pleasure. I'm sorry I missed last week.
Things happen. You say in the book, and I was thinking afterward, you say in the book, and I wondered about this, you're back with all the passion and all the kind of fever and quite a story here, but you open it up saying nothing happens by accident, and you end the book saying almost the opposite, you know, that you've got your characters understanding the power of accident and magic in human affairs. So which is it, Pat? Nothing happens by accident, or accident and the magic or rule?
You know, I think nothing happens. There seems to be, in my own life, a pattern. And most of the time, I do not know I'm in that pattern, Tom. And it's only later, when I look back, a friend will come up to me in the airport. Someone will be in line when I'm signing books. And generally, when I look back on my life, and I'm 63 now, things have happened for a reason. It's not always the reason I want. Many times I wish it had not been the reason. I've married people I didn't want to marry and should not have married. But, you know, fate comes in, taps you on the shoulder, and generally you follow it. No matter what you want to do, somehow this thing seems almost preordained to me.
You know, in the pages of your books, people really struggle. They have a good time, too. They live large. They talk big. They live in sort of supercharged environments in your marvelous description. But you know, there's so much suffering and suicide and depression and all the rest. I know you've known this in your own life. You're 63, as you say now. Does that, you know, do you buy the notion that writers need to have that kind of trauma? Did you need to have that kind of trauma to be?
You know, usually, Tom, when I talk to people, is – to me, life has been much tougher than I thought it was going to be. And I thought it was going to be very tough. I had a couple come up in line when I was signing books, I guess about 2000. And there were one of these couples, I can always tell them, things were going well in their lives. This was a fraternity president. This was a sorority girl from a big sorority.
A nice polish on the loafers, a nice shine.
Okay. And these were, I mean, these were great-looking people. Mm-hmm. And the guy looks at me when I'm signing his book, and he said, "Conroy, your family's crazy, aren't they?" And I said, "Yeah. How about your family, pal?" He said, "My family's great." And I said, good, while we're speaking honestly, tell me this. How far do we have to go in your family before I hit the first wacko, the first crazy? Mom, dad, brother, sister, aunt, uncle. The wife couldn't stand it, Tom. And finally she blurts out, his mother's nuts. And so generally, I don't have to go very far about finding something pretty bad in the family life of anybody I meet.
Pat Conroy, listen with this for a second. This will take us all back, but it's when a lot of readers may have first encountered you, the huge, huge success of The Prince of Tides. Enormous number of readers, and then a lot of viewers in the cinema as well. Barbra Streisand produced it and directed it and came out in 91 with a screen adaptation with Nick Nolte. And here's a little scene kind of to this point where he plays a troubled man, of course, who falls in love with his suicidal sister's psychiatrist, played by Streisand. And here he's just found out about a book his sister secretly published that divulges family secrets.
Tell me who wrote this book.
Why don't you tell me?
Oh, I'll tell you. My sister wrote it. It's all about my goddamn family. If my mother ever read it, she'd rip out Savannah's pancreas with her teeth.
Why? Why would she do that? What are you all hiding?
I don't answer any more questions till you answer mine.
Then why don't you sit down and listen? That is, if you're not too exhausted by your temper tantrum.
Barbra Streisand and Nick Nolte all fired up in The Prince of Tides. You've got a big family, Pat, and you've put a lot of family life out on the page in the course of your writing life. I want to talk a little about the movies later, but what about your family? You're 63 now. Are they all kind of come to terms with you marching the family drama out on the world stage?
No, and I'm praying they're not listening to this. I'm writing a book now, which has put terror into every member of my family, is I want to write about Dad's death and Dad's remarkable change before he died.
This is your famously fierce father.
Oh, my Lord. I've been to Boston. Houghton Mifflin was my first publishing company. And the Boston Irish, I looked around when I was up there and I said, okay, these folks will know what I'm talking about. They will know what I'm saying. But Dad was as ferocious a father as anybody I've ever met. What surprised me about Dad, and to his great glory, after The Great Santini came out, my father decided to change who he was. And he spent the next 15 years of his life proving that I was a liar, that my portrait of him was not the whole portrait. And to my astonishment, my father died a greatly loved man.
So it can be done?
He did it. And I think I owe him the fact that he did it. But of course, my siblings and my relatives are terrified what will go into this next book, and which will be the last book I write about the family.
As you, the next one, as you describe him coming out of that ferocity, tell us about this one, South of Broad, Pat Conroy, set in Charleston, clearly turf that you love, and it's lovingly described on page after page here in the most vivid way. You've got a group of friends around. Well, you tell us.
I'm sorry, Miss Sense.
Just the story that you're unfolding in South of Broad. Give us just the gist of it.
Okay, I'm missing the question, Tom.
Yeah, just the heart of the story here is a young man in Charleston, South Carolina, whose brother commits suicide when they're both young. He's even younger. And you've written the whole thing really about the circle of friends that he develops in a way to try and pour into the hole left by that brother's death, I guess, over the course of his life.
Well, there's no question. And friendships have proven very important to me in my life. And I like the way they can change your life and the direction of your life. And as I look back on my life now, I like seeing which ones survived. Which friends were left behind, which friends decided not to make the journey. And then those who have stuck with me through thick and thin, through divorces, through insanity, through everything else that has afflicted my family, these people that have stuck around, I've now known for 40 years. And I cherish them. And I try to let them know that in these books.
In a way, this seems like a gift to the friends who floated you through. It seems like you, this time, putting maybe transfigured for the book, but putting them on display this time, saying it's kind of a thank you note from Pat Conroy.
Well, you know, I hope it is, and I hope it works out that way, and I hope they think of it that way. Thus far, they've not told me.
Your father became easier as he moved along in life. Have you, Pat? Is life easier for you after the divorces and the breakdown at one point in the books and the success and all the rest?
No, you know, life will not be easy for me ever, nor will it be easy for the people around me forever. You know, I don't think there's any way of curing a bad childhood. And I think you carry that on as luggage the rest of your life. And the bad childhood is going to be something I wear on my back like a camel's hump. And I deal with it the best I can. And certainly I've dealt with it, Tom, by trying to write about it and trying to write truthfully about it. And that has caused much displeasure among my family members, especially among my brothers and sisters. But I also will tell them, man, did they give me some great characters to write about?
Was it worth it? Can you look at it as a writer that way? Would you give up the success as a writer if you could have had a happy childhood?
You know, the success as a writer is, you know, that's been a surprise to me. I had no idea that by writing about a family, and I'd never heard the phrase dysfunctional family before I wrote The Great Santini, had no idea I had lived in one. Because I simply did not know the phrase. But once I heard the phrase, I realized I was a native of that country. And I knew that, you know, this is something I know a lot about. And what you try to do is not carry that on into the next generation.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with legendary storyteller and passionate novelist of the South, of the human heart, Pat Conroy, author of The Prince of Tides, The Great Santini, and now South of Broad. Pat Conroy joins us from Birmingham, Alabama today. In his new book, South of Broad, there is a kind and wonderful father, maybe the first in Pat Conroy's work. It wasn't that way in The Great Santini. Here's Robert Duvall, played Bull Meacham, a Marine pilot who struggles between being a loving and abusive father in the 1979 film. Here he confronts his son for leaving the house to take a friend to the hospital.
You disobeyed a direct order, Hogg! A direct order from your commanding officer!
Yes, sir!
You knew you'd catch hell for it!
Yes, sir!
Went ahead and did it anyway! I want to know why!
Yes, I thought... I promised Arabelle I thought Toomer might be in trouble.
And what?
And because I was your son.
Robert Duvall as Bull Meacham, modeled on Pat Conroy's father in The Great Santini. Oh, boy, we all wanted to run from that, Dad. But, Pat, in South of Broad, you have the opposite. You've got a warm and loving and you've got a cold mother here, but you've got one wonderful father. what kind of exercise was that to write?
It was wonderful. You know, I've spotted really good fathers as I've been growing up, and along the way, I reparented myself with these men and women of friends of mine all throughout my childhood. And I knew men that were so gentle, so wonderful to their kids, and I've been watching them for a long time. And every kid I've ever written about has been beaten to a pulp by his father, and I thought, you know, it's time for me to write about a good one. It's time for me to put into practice the things I've seen good fathers do. And it was an absolute pleasure to pretend I was related to such a man and that I could produce such a man.
And a real change of pace from old Bull Meacham. Pat Conroy is with us, and we've got a lot of callers who want to speak with you, if we may, Pat. Let's take a first call from down Charleston Way, Sumter, South Carolina. Robert, you're on the air with Pat Conroy.
Yes, sir. It's an honor to speak with you there, Mr. Conroy. I'm from Sumter, and I got interested after I seen The Prince of Tides. And what I was wondering, I know you already spoke about how a lot of things in your family life has affected you, but when your brother, he committed suicide, I believe, and Did that, you know, really affect you a lot in your writing, or help you, or hurt you in your writing, you think?
Well, here's what happened. With my brother Tom, he was a paranoid schizophrenic. And when he was 34 years old, he threw himself off a 14-story building in Columbia, South Carolina. At the time, I was writing beach music, and the youngest brother I had commit suicide in the book. But when I got the call, I went back in the book and threw those pages away. And I said, this book has enough pain in it. I'm not going to have this kid kill himself now that he's actually done it in real life. So I had a resurrection. You know, the kid lived. And it's one of the powers of being a novelist I like. I did not have to have him kill himself. And as far as the effect on all of us, it was a life-changing thing. And it was life-changing for my father. And I remember after Tom's body was found, Dad was walking into my brother Mike's house in Columbia. I called him up. And my father, who, as you can imagine, Tom, does not weep very much, did not cry very much. But that death of Tom devastated him. And he gets on the phone with me, and he says, he was my baby, Pat. I lost my baby. And he was weeping uncontrollably. And he said, Tom never had a chance. He always got the short end of the stick. So we had the funeral the next day. Dad wept through the whole funeral. He cried the whole way. And we'd never seen Dad cry. You know, Dad was not like that. So after the funeral, we come home, and the surviving six, we have a little meeting, and we decide, okay, Dad did love us. Didn't know how to show it, but the death of Tom proves that he loved us all. And so at that time, we decided, okay, let's forgive him for that childhood. Let's, you know, give him a free pass.
That's pretty big. Easy to say, but hard to do, given what we know of your shared childhood.
Very good question, Tom. It was, you know, you always have that childhood traveling with you. But what it was it was a good thing for us to see Dad devastated by the death of one of his children. And because we didn't know he felt any different about Tom than he did. You can imagine my father, a Marine fighter pilot, with a schizophrenic son. And it just changed the way all of us dealt with Dad from then to the day he died.
I've got a question on this front from Charlestown, Massachusetts. Let me go to Steve. Steve, you're on the air with Pat Conroy.
Well, it's great to hear you, Pat, and thank you very much for the program, Tom. Pat, I'm a longtime reader of yours and a fellow Citadel guy.
Graduate of the military school, the Citadel, the same one Pat Conroy famously graduated from and got in trouble with. Okay.
No, and I got myself in trouble, too, but to correct the record, I did not graduate.
Oh, okay.
Perhaps because I dealt with the issues that I have with my father a little differently than Pat did. My father managed to be indicted, tried, and convicted for embezzling money from the federal government, spent years in prison. I left the Citadel because I was the oldest of 10 kids and went to work and never looked back. But the Citadel remained a very important part of my life, and I've continued to be connected to it. But the purpose for my call, Pat, is on our similarities of background, and in particular, perhaps if I might be so bold as to suggest our similarities with our father. I have found that when you come across these gigantic personalities, these all-encompassing, powerful men, typically, it's difficult to challenge them for their behavior because more often than not, they suggest that the contemporaneous issues they're dealing with justifies it. But I would imagine, and I'm asking you a question now, that one could see as a great gift you gave your father in writing The Great Santini. I would imagine, as with the circumstance with Tom, your father greatly loved you, but had a difficult time expressing it. That was my experience with my father. But here, in a book, a comprehensive picture of this alter ego, you give him a real sense of how he's being perceived by others. And I think, like any individual who has the capacity to love, he says to himself, I got to change. I got to be less whom I'm being perceived as and more whom I'd like to be.
It's a beautiful idea. You can imagine it. But what about the fact, Pat Conroy? Did the great Santini, in fact, was it welcomed by your dad, or did he want to whack you around again like he used to do?
Well, he threw the book across the room and stomped it the first time he read it. And that has become a legend in the family. What Dad fell in love with, Tom, is he fell in love with Hollywood. And he would say things to me like, what a shame John Wayne is dead, son. Only he could get my virility across to the American people.
Duvall wasn't good enough with that performance?
No, Dad, Duvall, it was...
Oh, my gosh.
Even in our family, Duvall was controversial. Even with Dad. And, you know, Dad saw Duvall and he said, they got a midget to play me, son. And he was offended that neither the great Santini nor the son in the movie, Duvall and Michael O'Keefe, could play basketball the way he played basketball. And he went through all these little things. And, you know, then when the book came, I mean, when the movie came out, Dad went crazy. And it, I mean, he went to the movie 1,000 times.
You mean he liked it?
Subscribed to Variety, you know, for God's sakes. Mm. And it changed his life. He signed the book beside me. And he would sit beside me at a signing table. And I said, Dad, what right do you have to sign my book?
Yeah.
And he'd say, I am the reason the people are reading your book, son. The other people in the book are colorless. And I add juice. I add virility. I add manliness. And my favorite moment in the whole thing of Dad's change is when the Academy Awards were announced that year. Hmm. Dad came flying into my apartment, as happy as I've ever seen him. And he said, son, you and I were nominated for Academy Awards last night. Your mother didn't get squat. So it changed Dad. I mean, that perception of himself, he liked the Hollywood part.
But to Steve's question about where lies the power to change people, as I hear you, it took your brother's actual death, suicide, Tom's suicide to change your dad, not so much the revelations about his own behavior that you put in front of him in the great Santini.
Well, you know, it was a combination of things. I mean, mm-hmm. Dad, it was a long time coming. The final act was Tom's suicide. There's, you know, no question about that. Yet he had been coming to that, you know, before all this took place. And I think my mother's divorcing him devastated him. And when I asked him, Dad was tremendously upset. He came to visit me in Atlanta. And he was shaken by this divorce decree and going to court. And I said, Dad, do you understand what happened? Do you understand what you did? And he said, yes. And he was shaky about this. And I said, well, what was wrong, Dad? What do you see is what was wrong in the way you raised your children, the way you were a husband and a mom? Hmm. And Dad said, without irony, I was too good. I should have cracked down harder. Boy. And I looked at him gaping, and I said, Caligula couldn't have cracked down harder. Nero couldn't have cracked down harder. Dad, you got to start thinking about this. But it was a long time coming, Tom. And it wasn't just one thing. It was 1,000 things. But he did it.
In your new book, South Abroad, the father is kind of warm and wonderful. The mother is the cold one. She turned out to be a former nun. Her son doesn't know that at the beginning. Who is obsessed with James Joyce. And she is one hard, cold, implacable mother, kind of the toughest kind of mother superior, even once she's left the order and is raising him.
Yes, I know my nuns well. and I know Catholic schools well. And one of the things I love best in the world is getting 50s Catholics together to talk about our life among nuns. And some of these women were just the most superb teachers. But I fell in love with this Mother Superior type. And I've known a lot of nuns that got married during the 60s, during Vatican II. And so I followed this little thing of what happens when they get married, what happens when they have children. And I discovered when they have children, they raise them as though they were nuns.
As though they were still nuns themselves. They've still got the ruler.
They cannot wash the nun out of themselves, no matter what they do. And it has tickled me over the years to watch this take place.
There's a pretty tough indictment buried in this book of some infamous aspects of Catholic Church clergy behavior. What's your relationship with the Catholic Church now,
Pat? Well, the Catholic Church is always, you know, what I tell people is this time, I'll be a Catholic until I die. There's nothing I can do about it. They got me. And I'm not a good Catholic. I'm not an observant Catholic. But I'm Catholic. I don't think you can change that. I cannot convert to become a Baptist or an Episcopalian. Catholicism to me is like being black. It's like being Jewish. It's like being Korean. It's, you know, anything that you cannot escape from, Catholicism strikes me as the same. So I'm Catholic, a bad one, yet some sense of wonder was imparted to me by that religion. Some sense of grandeur was given to me because I was raised a Catholic in the most serious way.
And that wonder and grandeur in nearly every page of every book. Sarah, Charlotte, North Carolina, you're on the air with Pat Conroy.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How you doing?
Hi. I'm great. It's so nice to actually be able to speak with you, Pat. The reason I was calling, I just wanted to thank you just for the great body of work that you've produced. I actually read Beats Music when I was 9 years old, which was probably inappropriate for a 9-year-old, but it introduced me to literature in a new way that has kept me reading throughout my entire life. And
what did you read at 9 years old? I'm curious.
Beats Music.
Oh, my gosh. Your parents should be put in jail.
No, I actually read it at my grandmother's house. My Wayne Conroy, who I believe is in your family, is also in my family. And so we had some signed copies, and I thought, ooh, this looks exciting. And my grandmother didn't know that I was reading it.
Oh, boy.
Good. She gets a free pass then.
I also read The Water is Wide when I was in high school, and it led to me now actually being in education. And I've just, you know, always read your books, and I've recommended them. When I was in college, I really enjoyed The Lords of Discipline. It's just always been a part of my life. And I wanted to thank you for the great work and sticking with it. I loved My Losing Season. I loved everything that you've done for approaching really challenging issues in a new way and then in a consistent way. I love just the introspective way that you address your characters. And I just wanted to thank you for such a great body of work.
Sarah, we've got to ask you, did your jaw drop as you read Beach Music as a 9-year-old? Were you freaked out? Did you have to run and ask questions of somebody? Did you bury it in the backyard?
There were a lot of things I didn't understand, and but I didn't. I actually
thank
didn't
the Lord. And how? Where do I send the check to thank you for this phone call?
Right. No, that's great. Sarah, thanks so much for your call, Pat. There's a 9-year-old that you led by the hand into the groves of literature.
Oh, my Lord.
And she's still there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with legendary storyteller and passionate novelist of the South of the Human Heart, Pat Conroy, author of The Prince of Tides, The Great Santini. His new book is South of Broad. Pat Conroy joins us today from Birmingham, Alabama. His new book, South of Broad, is set in Charleston, South Carolina. And Pat, I wonder if you'd be kind enough just to read the opening couple of paragraphs here that sets us in that remarkable city.
I would be delighted. This is the first part, first page of the book. It was my father who called the city the mansion on the river. He was talking about Charleston, South Carolina, and he was a native son, peacock proud of a town so pretty. It makes your eyes ache with pleasure just to walk down its spellbinding narrow streets. Charleston was my father's ministry, his hobby horse, his quiet obsession, and the great love of his life. His bloodstream lit up my own with a passion for the city that I've never lost nor ever will. I'm Charleston born and bred. The city's two rivers, the Ashley and the Cooper, have flooded and shaped all the days of my life on this storied peninsula.
Pat Conroy reading right from the beginning of South of Broad there, and Broad, a street that defines Charleston in a way. We've got a Charleston caller in Chesapeake, Virginia. Tommy, you're on the air with Pat Conroy. What do you know of Charleston, Tommy?
Well, hello, and thank you for taking my call. I was moved to 11 Legree Street when I was 2 years old. We lived in an apartment there, and I roamed the walls of Charleston as a child. And I never appreciated at that time how beautiful all the gardens and the patios and the driveways, the stone work, how beautiful it was. And to this day, I'm so excited to get this book because it's going to bring back a passion that I have always had for Charleston. It's just incredibly beautiful. And we lived on South Battery for a while, too. So South of Broad, just it hit me. When I heard you talk about this coming up, I had to listen to Mr. Conroy. And thank you for all your great work.
And Tommy, when he says South of Broad, you know well what he means, but many may not. What does it mean in Charleston? What's it mean to you, Tommy, South of Broad?
South of Broad was where the more expensive, older, different styles of homes were. We were not wealthy. My dad actually was a bartender at the Fort Sumter Hotel,
mm-hmm.
so we could afford to live in an apartment down there. But Broad Street was a defining street separating Charleston, and I'm just amazed at how beautiful they have kept it and restored it. King Street is just gorgeous, and every time I go back, I just fall in love with it again. Charleston is my mistress.
Hey, that's Pat Conroy talking. He talks about the delicate porcelain beauty of Charleston, like the hinged shell of some soft-tissued mollusk in South of Broad. Pat Conroy, Tommy loves it. A lot of people love it when they get there. It's the first time you've made it the base for an entire book in this way.
You know, Charleston was, when I first went there, my English teacher, Gene Norris, took me there. And when we got to Broad Street and Meeting Street, he says, "Now, boy," he had a great Southern accent, "Now, boy, I'm going to change your life forever, boy." And you watch and you listen, because when I make this right-hand turn, for the first time in your life, your sorry Southern self is going to be South of Broad. And it's got the most beautiful homes, most beautiful architecture, most wondrous antiques inside here. He took a right, and it changed my life. I never thought I would name a book after it. But I was 15 then. I didn't even know I was going to be writing books.
Right. You've made it the intersection for all kinds of people, high class, low class, cross race, sexuality, you name it. You're taking it as a kind of canvassed for this big pastiche of people. Why Charleston for that background? Just because?
Okay, Tom. The thing about South of Broad, the phrase itself, is everybody has to define themselves in some way by South of Broad, whether you're black, white, Jewish, you live north of Broad, or you live in North Charleston, you live west of the Ashley, you live in Spartanburg, Greenville, Columbia. You've got to make this distinction of how you relate to this one part of the world, which it was aristocratic, which was filled with a love of the place and a love of the landscape, unlike many found in the United States. When I was published by Houghton Mifflin, I walked, is it Back Bay?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, there's always a place like that in every city you go to. Mm-hmm. I'm here in Birmingham, and when I married Cassandra King, the novelist, she told me that I needed to know about Mountain Brook. The Mountain Brook in Birmingham represented what the South of Broad did in Charleston. But there's always a place like this in every city. And you come up against it, and how you handle it is a story the rest of your life.
Your descriptions are so beautiful, so lyrical, going all the way back to the Low Country and the South Carolina coast and the Prince of Tides, and again here in South Abroad, set in Charleston. And I wonder, you know, I've read Gene Norris quoted somewhere saying he was sorry that you got a hold of Thomas Wolfe so early on and became, I guess, enthralled with the kind of very, very rich, Baroque even language of Thomas Wolfe. And you've got people who describe your work as lyrical and then others who describe it as florid. And you must have read this again and again as a criticism. You must have read this, you know, all through your career. You're 63 now. You've got so much out there. How do you look at that? Dallas Morning News says, you know, linguistic overindulgence. On the other hand, they're swept away by it. You know, you're a passionate guy. You wear it on your sleeve. You wear it on the page. How do you look at that florid tag? Is that just part of
it? It's been part of my writing life. And give me the name of the person from Dallas who wrote that, and I promise you'll never hear of them again, ever. And it just is, you know, I came across some letters I'd written in high school. In fact, they were to Mr. Norris. Mm. And I see it, and I said, my gosh, it was there even then.
In your own style.
Yeah, there it was. Mm-hmm. You know, I picked this up early. And I think a prose style is like your personality. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, mine is florid, show-offy, Baroque, all these things. My personality is overdone, overblown. But
is that unfortunate or is that a gift?
You know, I think it's a gift. It's, I discovered fairly early that I had a lyric gift, and I've tried to be true to it. Not everybody does. And Thomas Wolfe, Fitzgerald, Faulkner, they got to me. Whereas, you know, Hemingway, it is good and it is fine.
Right.
that school never quite did it for me because I did not know where to go with the great emotions I felt. And the English language is a garden I like drifting through. And I think it's a pretty language. And I've tried to make it pretty in my books.
It sure is. Cole in Pensacola, Florida. You're on the air with Pat Conroy.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Pat. Mm-hmm. My question to you, Pat, is where do you feel you fall in the long tradition of Southern writers, more specifically Gothic Southern writers such as Walker Percy, Flannery O'Connor? I know that you all share the Catholicism in your works, and it seems to direct you forward. I mean, do you feel that you have gotten a lot from their works and channeled that into yours as far as drawing upon your own past?
It's a great question, Cole. Thank you. Pat Conroy?
Walker Percy and Flannery O'Connor are much better writers than I am. They were both Roman Catholic, but I sent word through a friend to Walker Percy one time that I did not consider him a real Roman Catholic. He was a convert. And I told him, you cannot be a real Roman Catholic unless you've been beaten up by a mustachioed 300-pound nun when you were a child. And only then do you know the true depth of the Catholic Church. But Flannery was, I love both those writers more than I can say.
When you say Walker Percy's a better writer, at your age, at your point in your career, does it pain you to say that? Or is that
no,
just the way life is? Or?
You know, life sometimes produces Walker Percy's. And I remember reading the Movie Goer. I think it was 1962 or 3 when it came out, and I went nuts. And I wish I could write like that, but my sensibility is different. The sensibility is different than Flannery O'Connor's. And, you know, you have to take what you are given. You have to take the gifts that are thrown your way, the cards that are dealt, and that's all you can do, and make as much out of that as you can.
We've got more callers, and I'll get to some, but we've got some things we have to ask you about as a writer out of the South. First of all, just, I mean, the South and how things are rolling here. Barack Obama is in the White House. The South had something to do with that, if you look back at the course of the campaign season we just came through. What do you make of that, Pat?
Well, it's the most wonderful thing that's happened in my lifetime, because I grew up in the Jim Crow South. I grew up with separate water fountains, back of the bus, and I never thought I would live to see someone like Barack Obama in the White House. It never occurred to me that I'd be voting for a black man to be the first black president. And I found it delightful, wondrous, miraculous, and I am glad I was alive when it happened.
Is the South had a hand in this? Is the South a different place? Is it time for us to, you know, adjust our understanding of the South? Is there something timeless that's never going to change, even on race?
Here's the one thing with the South. It is so complicated, complex, strange, and, you know, it has its own fingerprint. You know, I had people in my family vote for Barack Obama. I thought they'd had nervous breakdowns. I couldn't believe it. And there was something about this man that simply transcended race. And even in the South, it amazed me that Virginia, North Carolina, and Florida voted for Barack Obama. Mm. It simply astonished me and gave me great hope for the future.
I've got to ask something out of the political world on a different, lesser scale, but nevertheless, it kind of fits almost into the something I could read out of one of your books, South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford and his infamous affair with an Argentine love in, you know, interviews where he's talking about a love story, a forbidden one, a tragic one, a love story. It sounds almost like Pat Conroy when the governor gets to the podium lately. What do you make of what we've all watched with him and his wife Jenny and moving to Sullivan Island there off Charleston and all the rest? What do you make of this story?
Well, South Carolina is a small state, and I think Governor Sanford was in my brother Tom's graduating class from high school. And so I've, you know, known the family, met Governor Sanford's mother coming out of the doctor's office the other day. And she surprised me by telling me she had a bit part in the Great Santini, which I had no idea about. And it's what it is people, you know, will tell me I overwrite, I exaggerate. Hmm. I don't think the South can be exaggerated. You know, I think the Sanford thing, what has amazed me, I keep thinking, yeah, I need to meet some of these Argentinian women. I mean, these people have changed the world that I was born into. But what has struck me as remarkable is his wife, Jenny, has gotten the best reviews of any woman I've ever seen come out of South Carolina for the way she has acted. You know, the dignity and restraint and but solidness in which she has treated this in her life.
Dignity on her part, some kind of high romance on his part. One more call here, Aiken, South Carolina. Bob, you're on the air with Pat Conroy.
Yes, hi, Pat and Tom. I am one that wears the ring also with and carries around this love-hate confliction. I was there 3 of the 4 years that you were there.
You're talking about the Citadel, the military school, the ring of the Citadel grad. Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Class of 66, and I appreciate you've done. Pat.
By the way, you tortured me when I was a child.
Yes,
I was 67.
I did, probably. I was in A Company, so I was with some of your fellow basketball players, and I wanted to say, contrary to what Pat claims, he was a good basketball player.
Point guard.
And that's one of the fond recollections I have of watching him play basketball.
And what about when he went after the Citadel, you know, and really painted a dark picture of it? Were you offended, Bob, or did you say, yep, that's
no,
it?
No, not at all. In fact, I feel in some ways that I've followed sort of a parallel track, but it's a contrary one. Pat had early on a hate relationship. Mine is developed in later years, I guess you would say. So I didn't I didn't feel strongly or badly at all about his about the views that he expressed. And I also want to say one of the things I like most about Pat's books is the way he mixes fact and fiction so that you can hardly tell the difference. And that came through clearly to me in The Lords of Discipline, which, of course, was a mimic of the Citadel in many ways. And I wanted to say that I ran into a mutual acquaintance the other day, Brett Bercy from Columbia, and
he was a high school radical at Buford High School.
Yes, okay. Yeah, well, he's still a radical 40 some years later, and a great one. But he mentioned that he had a couple of appearances in Prince of Tides, I think it was. So
he did. He had a starring role in the Prince of Tides, yeah. And I loved it that Brett became a radical, because I remember when he was elected best dressed at Buford High School.
You guys got us off on a real beam here, and that's good. Bob, thank you for calling. You know, it's not just in the Carolinas. I was sitting with a neighbor of mine up here the other day and saying, I was going to talk with you, Pat, and she said, oh, well, I named my son after Tom Wingo. I mean, whether it's
my gosh.
Boston or Buford, you name it. You name it.
And what a terrible wait for a child to grow up in.
And yet she did. You never know where the shoe is going to drop. Pat Conroy, the new book is South Abroad. It's been wonderful talking with you. I hope you'll come again after you, if you wrap up a new book on your dad. We'd love to hear about it, Pat. Thanks for joining us today.
Tom, I had a ball.
Pat Conroy, author of The Prince of Tides, The Great Santini, and now South Abroad, joining us there from Birmingham, Alabama. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.